want to welcome you all to USAR 2017, especially if this is your first USAR. I'm sure you're going to really enjoy it. So this is the first day of the meetings, and it's an all tutorials day. And this is going to be the sports analytics, and so we'll cover the first half of the day. There'll be two sessions with a break in between. So just some logistical things. I know a lot of you have your computers and are probably wondering about power supplies. Unfortunately, the room doesn't really, it's not equipped, but the break rooms just across the hall do have plenty there. So whenever we have a break, if you need to charge up then, I would suggest just heading over there, and I'm sure there's a similar setup on the other floors if it gets crowded. Another question I wanted to ask, did you all receive this syllabus before today? Okay, maybe, could anyone raise their hand if they did not get this? Oh, wow, okay, that is not good. Yeah, unfortunately, they would not let me communicate directly with you guys, so I was not sure this went out. Okay, so this basically has information about some things to install if you want to follow along with any of the exercises today. I think the really key one is going to be this DUCE package, because that's going to have some of the data sets and things that we'll be using during. So I would suggest to try to go ahead and download this here using the DevTools command. So you'll first need to make sure that you have DevTools installed. This package here, and then you can just use this command, install GitHub, and then the scoval/DUCE to get the DUCE package. You'll need to have a Wi-Fi connection to actually install the package, and you can do that just by finding the conference USAR. You don't need any authentication to connect to that. So once you're connected to that, go ahead in R to try and install the DUCE package. It may take a few minutes. The connection seems fairly good here, but it may take a few minutes just because the data sets in this package are quite large. But we're not going to do exercises right away, but so you'll have some minutes to try to do that. These are some other packages. All these in blue are also ones that we'll be using. And we can probably, just along the way, you'll notice when I introduce a package, and you could then try to install it in that at that point if you haven't already. And then I'll just chat with the organizers to make sure that you do get this file, hopefully by the end of today, but certainly after the tutorial so that you can refer back to it. Okay, so is everyone okay with this command? You have the information you need to install? And then I'll just leave that leave this in the background, and I'll get started with this section. So hopefully you can do that installation while we go through this first section. Okay, so as I said, this is the sports analytics section. I just wanted to introduce myself to you all. So my name's Stephanie. I'm currently a research fellow at Victoria University in Melbourne, Australia. Not originally from there, as you can probably tell from my accent, but that's where I am now. And I also am the principal data scientist for a group, the Game Insight Group, or GIG, at Tennis Australia, where we do a lot of performance analysis for elite tennis. I also run a blog called On the Tee, and my Twitter handle for my tennis stats stuff is Stats On the Tee, if you're interested in that. So a lot of the examples I'm going to have are from tennis, because that is what I know best. But I do want to make sure that what we're going over, that you understand that it's very relevant, I think, to all sport and even other types of data analysis. So I think this should be fairly general. Okay, as I mentioned, our primary package for the course that we'll be using is DUCE. This is going to be the main support for the data sets, data examples we'll be using. The course tutorial is really just a collection of PDFs that I will make sure are available to you after the course so that you'll have that as a reference. And I'll try to coordinate with the organizers to make sure all the attendees can get a hold of those. And if you do have any questions, if for some reason you're not getting those emails or things like that, please do contact me. Feel free, you know, with any questions related to today's tutorial. So first, just to give an overview of what we're going to talk about today. So I've organized the workshop into six different sections, and I wanted them to just focus on, I think, what are some of the major activities that are involved with being a sports statistician. So the first part, we're going to talk about sports data and actually getting a hold of it. And then we're going to talk about web scraping, because often we'll find the sports data we're interested in exists somewhere on the web. And so we need to be able, particularly if we're going to be collecting masses of those data and maybe doing it over time, to be able to automate those processes. So we'll talk about some web scraping tools in R that will allow us to do that. Then third section will be on data wrangling. So usually when we're working with data from the web, it can tend to be messy, and we'll have to apply various kinds of steps to get that data in shape, in the sort of structure, make sure that it's clean and valid before we're able to do any analysis. And I think after that third section, we'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll then talk about exploring our data. I'll have a brief section on modeling, so focusing on forecasting, which is a pretty common research area in sports statistics. And then finally, I wanted to just show you some tools in R that can make blogging a lot easier, and this is a really great way to share your ideas in sport and other analysis with the world. So before I get started, I just want to ask, how many of you would say that you're a beginner in R, that you're just kind of getting started? A little bit? Okay, because I'm pitching this a little bit at, you know, I wouldn't say super advanced, but I'm kind of assuming that you understand the basis of the language. So just to be able to get into, you know, the meaty stuff related to actual sports analytics, but definitely, you know, if there's anything that's new, you have a question about, please feel free to interrupt as we go along. Okay, so the first section is all about finding sports data. And what I wanted to talk about in this section was I've categorized sports data into four different types that I think sort of encompass the major categories that are out there. And it's helpful, I think, to have this sort of structure when you're thinking about the data so that you know what type you're interested in. It makes it easier to actually track those data down. So the four basic types, I put them into box scores, performance metrics, tracking data, and then wearable data. So I want to say a little bit about each of those. So the box scores are the most basic types of sports data. It could be, you know, a home run count from a baseball game or just the final score line. So it's usually just some summary of an event that happened within a particular sporting competition. And these data are the most readily available. So there's usually, depending on the sport, there can be quite a historical record of box scores. And here actually is an example from a newspaper showing some score lines from a baseball game from 1876. So in baseball in particular, it goes back quite a long time. But you'll see a lot of sports will have pretty good record of the outcomes of different events. Performance metrics here, these are generally things that are going to be built off of box scores, but will generally look over sort of a long time span. And they can have varying objectives, but often in sport we're interested in maybe using measures derived from box scores to, say, track team rankings, power, things like that. So you might see, for example, that in soccer you would use a team's, you know, goal differential over the course of a season as some measure of their strength. And here's an example actually showing some ratings for tennis players. So the main characteristic about these is that they're sort of summary stats, and they tend to be kind of time series or longitudinal data. Next is an area or type of data that's becoming particularly popular and more readily available in sport, and this refers to tracking data. Tracking data is really a kind of spatial, temporal data. It usually gives positional coordinates of the ball or maybe even players over the course of a sporting event in fairly continuous time. The image that you see here is an example of a shot chart, which was developed by Kirk Goldsberry, who used to work for Grantland and is involved with the XY research team, which is kind of a group of basketball statisticians. But this was a really sort of popular visualization that was created by that group as a way to highlight or essentially map players' shooting and their effectiveness in different parts of the court. So with this example for LeBron James highlighting his effectiveness around the area of the court. So this is all derived from tracking data, and it really opens up a lot of possibilities in what we can say about the quality of performance. And then a somewhat related area of data are wearable technologies. So these would be things that generally would be sensors worn by an athlete or maybe integrated into the ball used for that particular sport. And they can track various things. Sometimes it might follow biometrics. Sometimes it might actually provide positional data itself, like a GPS tracking device. The image that you see here is actually taken from the Vittoria Uni biomechanics lab where I work and is showing an example of using wearables to evaluate kicking for an Aussie Rules player. So this is becoming a more common use. I would say it's probably still somewhat based in more lab work rather than used in competition, but I think that's something we'll see changing over time. So one thing I want to mention as well with these data are sort of the varying levels of availability, and so I just have kind of put together this conceptual curve to show how when we look across these four different major types of sport data, where their availability stands these days. So box scores, performance metrics, those things are generally going to be pretty readily available through the web. On the tracking data, the wearable data side, it's generally less accessible, and it may depend more specifically on the particular sport where that data is coming from in terms of how much is out there that you can get a hold of. Just something to be aware of, but hopefully, you know, this curve will rise for all of these data types over time. Okay, so there is a lot of sports data on the web, and as you can see from this list of different sources that are out there, depending on the sport of interest, you know, there's a lot to explore. So I've just put this together in case, you know, you're maybe just starting to get your hands into sports analysis. You might be interested in looking at these resources to see if they have the kind of data you're interested in. So not anything to memorize, but once, you know, you have the slides, hopefully this could be a resource for you to go back to and do some exploration. And we'll look at a few of these sources over the course of the tutorial. So one of the things that's really key when being a sports statistician is being able to sort of navigate the web and being able to sort of inspect sites and understand what kind of data is there. So I just put together some kind of case studies. So the first one, because often when you go to these sites, it's not actually clear where the data lie. So I wanted to put together a couple examples. So this first one is the hockeydb.com. If you all want to go ahead, if you have an internet connection, let's have a look at this site and try to determine where would data actually be stored. So I'm just going to open up this link in another tab. So if I go to the main site, you know, this is what I see. Now, a lot of it sort of seems like maybe news, information, and things. So where, if I'm interested in actually finding where stats are, Does anyone have some idea maybe the right part of this website to look at? Under links here. We can go here. So this seems kind of a hodgepodge. I could get probably lost there. How about this section here, this hockey stats? I would say this is probably going to be the key place, right? Where we want stats, so the hockey stats section is probably going to be where we're going to be most successful in tracking those down, and then it's just a matter of which in particular we're interested in, whether it's player-specific things or team-specific things. So that would be, you know, one way to start to kind of hone in on, okay, what is the key area of interest? And actually within this, there's, you can then try to, the next stage after kind of finding the main area would then be to try to understand exactly how that data is structured, how it exists. Is there a file you can just download, or is it just presented in, you know, an HTML table? And we'll see more of that in the next section. Okay, how about this other one? Let's have a look at this. This is football-data.co.uk, data.php. Let's open up this one. Okay. So I've got, you know, some information here about, so this is a betting site, so there's a lot of stuff here about, you know, being able to place bets on various things. But also, often these betting sites will also have historical data of interest. And so as an analyst, we're more interested in those historical data than necessarily, you know, future bets and things like that. So looking over this, where do you think maybe the key area of the site would be to get some actual data? Yeah, that looks promising. So let's open up this section. Oh, where's it going? Let me open that one up in a new tab. See. So now, if we scroll down, once we go to that site, we'll see that it's going to have a number of links that will go to some statistics for particular leagues and teams. So. So that was you're getting your skills sharpened for tracking down the data. So those are just two examples, and you can just see that with each site, you know, they're all going to be structured differently. There's no coordination among these. So you just have to kind of get a little, put your inspector cap on when dealing with these different websites. I did also want to mention that there are a few packages in R that are specifically focused on sports and different sort of analytics methods used in sport. Not a ton. I mean, often we can use some of the basic tools in R for doing most of what we need, but a number of these do actually have data sets that have already been pre-prepared for you, and that can be very useful if it's in an area of sport that you're already interested in. So we have some that are more kind of general purpose in this first group and have access to several data sets that cover a range of sport, as well as some tools like if you're interested in converting odds into probabilities, the odds converter package is focused on that. There's a soccer package, two packages focused on baseball. I wanted to particularly point out the Pitch RX, which allows you to access pitch FX data from MLB, and that's actually an example of tracking data. So you could have tracking data for some number of years from MLB pitchers. So that's a pretty special resource if you're interested in baseball analysis. The Deuce package is a package I put together to allow analysis of historical tennis data, and we'll see some examples from that during the tutorial. And then this Cricketer package would be some data sets that are based off of the ESPN cricket info. So there are a few out there, depending on your interests, which might be useful. Okay, so just a little bit more about the DUCE package. What exactly is in there? So I've put together sort of a centralized, my hope with this package is that it would become a sort of centralized place for data from some of the major websites on tennis. So that includes FlashScore, which is another kind of live scoring site for multiple sports, but it has a whole section devoted to tennis. The two main professional tours for the sport, the ATP for the men, the WTA for the women, and then the Tennis Abstract run by Jeff Sackman. So those all have a lot of different types of tennis data, and putting them all together allows us to be able to do things like looking at match results and scores and related stats from the open era up to the present. So that's around 1968 in tennis up to the present. There's historical rankings data, player demographics for all players that have competed at the professional level. There's also point level data. So if you're interested in kind of more detailed analysis about maybe the sequence of points, how common break points are in the sport, things like that, you would be able to do through the point level data resource, and that's available for a number of years for the Grand Slams. There's also shot level data. So this project that was started by Jeff Sackman called the Match Charting Project is kind of a crowdsourcing effort to get shot level data for tennis. So people code individual matches, and these may be historical matches based on what they've been able to find videos on, and then give information about the sequence of shots, I think some information about depth of shot. So that would be the sort of the richest level of data that's publicly available. So all of that you can get a hold of examples of through DUCE, and we'll see some of that today. So as I mentioned, if you haven't still got this one installed, hopefully by now it's loaded, and this would be the command you'd use. So the package is currently available through GitHub, and that would be, you know, the most up-to-date version. I think what's currently there is up-to-date through like February of 2017. And as I said, yeah, the data sets can be quite large because they do go back all the way. Some of them go back all the way to, like, the 60s. So, but it's, I think there's some pretty interesting stuff you can do with them. Okay, and just one thing. I don't know how many of you are used to using the man pages, but I always think it's very good when you're first starting to look to get familiar with a package to go to the help page and see the index of functions for that package. So just to give an example, if I go to R and I load this package, and then if I wanted to know just what's all the stuff that that package contains, well, I can do that with this help command here and just give the package name that I'm interested in. And when I do that, it will bring up an index of all of the data sets and functions associated with that package. You know, so then I can select on any one of these, for example, and get information about what that thing does. And it's just an easy way to get an overall sense of how much content and the nature of the methods that are available there. Just as a little practice, you can have a look at the man page for the ATP matches and determine exactly what that object would be in the package. So if I open that one up, for example, I see that this is one of the data sets provided by the package, and it's going to contain historical match results as well as some match statistics for more recent matches, so anything from like 1991 to the present. And then I can scroll down and see all of the different variables that are actually in that data set and how I would interpret them So often, I mean, hopefully things have been named well by the author. Sometimes that's not always the case, and we have to be able to use the man pages to sort that out. But I'm sure most of you are familiar with that. But just in case you're starting out, I think that's really useful skill, using the manual pages. Okay, so data. Are there questions on sports data? Anyone? Okay, so let's go on now and talk about scraping. Okay, so let's say you've found the data, you've got the website, you know what you're interested in. Then what do you do? This is where scraping comes in. Particularly if it's something where you're going to want to be able to reproduce the capture of those data and do this repeatedly. It's, you know, anything, if it's just a one-time deal, you could always just do manually, but often we're interested in repeating these processes, and we're going to want to use programming to make that all more efficient. So the scraping part isn't always the most fun thing that we have to do as a sports statistician, but it is kind of a necessary tool if you happen, you know, not to be fortunate enough to already have someone that's kind of done that work for you. So they're good skills to be familiar with, even if you're doing work outside of sport as well, it's relevant there. So there are two basic ways of getting the data. So you may be lucky enough that the data is already in a file that you can directly import. So that's one option. More often, the data already sort of exists within the site itself, and you'll have to be able to use some tools to extract it. So we'll talk about both of those. So as an example, in case you weren't aware, you've probably had examples of using importing functions in R, read table, read CSV, to import data from your own computer. This also works through URL addresses if you have an importable file, which could be a CSV, text file, anything that could be read by that function. So here's an example I wanted you to try out where we've taken a URL. So this one's from, it's a tennis betting site, tennisdata.co.uk. And what it is it's going to be a file for the 2017 AO. So I create an object called URL, which just stores that address, and then I can provide it to the read CSV function to import that and bring it in to my R session. So go ahead and give that a try, and what you'll see is I haven't stored this as an object, so it's just going to print out to the console, and then you can see what sort of data it contains. Okay, so go ahead and give a try at that, and I'll do it myself as well. Okay, so when I run those two lines, this is what I get. I get a data frame, and it has information all from the 2017 AO. And if I look further across the variables, I see that each row corresponds to a different match. It gives information about who won, who lost, their rankings, and then information about the score line. And then this site, it's a betting site, so it actually has information as well about what the pre-match prices were placed on each of the players, the winner and loser. And that could be information that gives you a sense of kind of what the win expectations were of each of those. So that's an example of just importing directly from the web. One thing in doing this is you'll notice, you know, when you are working with URLs and things like that, often, particularly anything that's within the same domain, will follow a kind of pattern. And it's good to sort of be attuned to that because it can make your life easier if you're able to sort of find these patterns, because that's all part of the things that we can use to help automate. Let's say I'm interested, I want all of the years of, you know, Australian Open data that the site has. I'm going to have to understand what all of the URL addresses would be for that Australian Open data. as another example, let's suppose that I was interested in the 2016 US Open and I wanted to extract the same data from that site. How do you think the URL would change for that event? But if it's the US Open, I'll probably also need to change the tournament name, yeah. So you can see that basically there's a pattern of like year and then event. So then it's just a matter of, you know, what year you're interested in and then how the developers of that site have named the event. So in this case, we could take a guess that it's 2016 and that the instead of Oz Open, it's probably just US Open. So you could go ahead and try that, and in this case now I'm going to save the results from that command with the new address to US Open. And then I just do a little structure on that data frame resulting from that URL address, which will give me an overall summary of the variables and the dimensions of the result. This one's taking a bit longer. So you'll find, if you look at that, it'll now be the 2016 results for the US Open, same variables, and there'll be 127 matches, which would be all of the main draw matches in a Grand Slam. In this case, it's just for the men's draw. Okay, so that's some examples of importing directly. But as I said, often we're going to have to actually scrape the data from the site itself. In doing this, one of the things we first have to be able to identify is what's the nature of that data in the site. And there are two main classes, I think, to put those data into. And it's important to be able to identify between the two because the methods that we'll use to scrape will change depending on which type it is. So those two types are static data, and dynamic data. And so we need to be able to understand what each of those types are and identify them from an individual site. So the main distinctions between the static data, so if the data is static, it means if I were to look at the source HTML for that web page, I would see the data within that page. The same, you know, numbers I'm interested in, there'll be some tagging, HTML tagging around it. But the actual values, the numerical values that I'm interested in, will be visible within the source. If you don't see the data, if you can't find it anywhere in the source, it means it's dynamically generated. So there's maybe a JavaScript function or something like this that is actually generating it depending on the user activity on the site. So those are the two main distinctions. Static data you can see, the dynamic you won't. And the methods that we'll use to extract those two different types will be somewhat distinct. So let's first have a look at how we would distinguish between the two. So first, you have to be able to have some tools that you can use to inspecting the sites themselves. I sometimes think of this as kind of going under the hood of the website. And this is just a little bit of an example of one site with some sports data. And when I look at the source code, what the source code looks like for those elements of the site. So you need to have a bit of familiarity with inspecting the HTML and some familiarity with CSS tags as well in doing the scraping. For most browsers, there will be like a view source or developer tools. Sometimes you might need to install them, but all browsers will have something like this that you can use, and this really just depends on maybe what your preference is for which browser you use. I like Chrome's set of developer tools, so that includes just a simple view source, and there's also sort of like an inspection console that will help to navigate pages, which can be useful particularly in kind of more, a lot of these sports sites that have a lot of like, you know, banners and kind of extraneous material. You just want to be able to get into the actual contents, and those developer tools can help you to do that. So here's an example if when using Chrome, of how you would actually go to use the view source. So once you have the developer tools in place, you would just go under view, and then you'll see a developer section. And then if I go to view source, what that will do is open up another tab that will then have the source code version of that same HTML page. And that's going to be the place where we'll do all of our searching, inspection, to try to figure out exactly, you know, what elements are these data contained in, and are they static or dynamic? Okay, so here's an example I want to go through just to help figure out this whole distinction. Sorry, was there a question in the back?
Yeah, I think with Windows, you don't have the toolbar in Chrome.
Uh-huh.
It's just, like,
icons. Oh, okay. But there still should be like a view icon.
On Chrome, is there a view?
Yeah, it may be that depending on your operating system, things look a little bit differently. But essentially, what you would want to do is, if it's not clear when you open up your browser, kind of what's going on, you could just search on the web about developer tools, and then that particular browser that you want to use, and that should take you exactly to the information that you need to track down. I think it's pretty common for all of the browsers to use the developer tools to refer to this kind of suite of functions that we're interested in. Okay, so just to get back to some examples here. Okay, so let's try this first site from the Tennis Abstract, and just to give an example of those tools, I'm going to use Chrome for this example. Okay, so I have the link, and if I go to navigate to this page, here's what it looks like, the actual displayed version. And as I mentioned before, so on Chrome, on a Mac, I'm going to go to the view source. And now this opens up the source page. Okay. So I will navigate this one. And what I'm trying to determine is, first, is the data static or dynamic? So I would scroll down. And exactly what do I mean by data? In this case, what I'm interested in would be the contents of this table, which has players and their ELO ratings, which is a kind of power ranking that's updated as players complete matches. So that's the data I'm interested in. So with respect to that, how would you classify these data based on the contents of the site? Because I can see that the contents of that table actually all here, right? Exactly. So this would be an example of static data. Okay. So let's look at our other example, which is taken from the ESPN Cricket Info. cricketinfo.com/ci/content/stats. So again, I'll go to Chrome. Ooh. Ooh, I may have missed something with this one. Okay, let's do. Oh, I see. My connection just dropped out. Oh, no. Yeah, it looks very weak. So everyone's lost the Wi-Fi. Yeah, unfortunately, my website, my lecture slides will not render without the connection as well. Okay. Well, I have PDFs as backup, so I'm just going to have to revert to that for the time being, and then if anyone can let me know when they, maybe it'll just pop up by itself. Oh, is it back? Okay. Well, we have a plan B in case, but let's try to go with this one. Maybe a bit slow. Okay, so let me see. Okay, here we go. So, now on this, for this example, the data that I'm interested in would be within this records table. Okay, so it seems to have particular players and sort of like their run results and things. So let's suppose I was interested in that. If I look under the source and try to find how that data is rendered. So we scroll. This one's quite long. One thing I can do is actually do a search within the view source for particular, maybe what I think would be like unique identifiers. Oh, actually, in this case, okay. So this content here actually would be, it looks like we would be able to get a hold of it as well. So this would be an example of static data. Before, when I had looked at it, I suppose I must have been looking at a different section. So that's on the slide. These should both be examples of static data. So sometimes when you look through these, though, you will find that there's just, I would not be able to, if in this case, if I had searched and nothing had been returned, that would have been an example then of a dynamic type of data. And we'll see actual examples of that when we get to the dynamic section. So one thing that you'll notice as we look through these, you know, there's a lot of content in the source files, and we want to be able to isolate the data of interest, and that usually means finding classes or IDs. These are CSS type of fields that are associated with those data, because once we know that, it'll actually make it a lot easier when we're giving instructions in R to be able to isolate those contents. So going back to the tennis abstract example, I'd like you to look at that source page and find out what class you think would be either an ID or a class variable that would help us to isolate those data. So first of all, the data is contained within an HTML table element. So what I would want to do would be to look around those table for information that could potentially uniquely identify those data. So looking at this page, does anyone have an idea what they might be? Okay, and what is its name? Reportable. And then we also see that there's a class, table sorter. So either of those would be potential ways to isolate that object in the HTML page. And then, oh, here I'm using an example just of if we were to open up the, let's see if we do this. If we open up the developer tools, it'll actually bring up sort of this console where you can select individual elements of interest, like the table, for example. But in this case, it's fairly easily observable just from the view source itself. Okay, so we found those two possible sources for identifying. Okay, so we pretty much have all the information that we would need if we wanted to extract those data. Now, how exactly do we go about doing that? One way is what I think of as kind of more of a brute force, which would be to use something like a read lines. And what that would do is if you gave it the URL of interest, it would just return every line by line exactly as it appears in the source. And then it would leave it to you to have to actually extract, do some kind of parsing to get at the data, identify the lines of interest and get those data. Now, you want to probably avoid that if the page already has a nice structure. So if there's already some structure there, like a table, you should be aware that there are already tools that will help to kind of use the structure of that table to help you avoid doing all of that kind of parsing and give you a result that's already in a nice format. So we're always kind of looking for a type of a data frame-like structure. So I think one of the packages that's most helpful in doing this, and there are more than one, but I particularly like the RVEST package. So what RVEST is it's kind of a suite of tools for gathering data from the web. And one of the nice things about it is if you're used to the whole like tidyverse set of packages like dplyr or tidyr, you actually can use the piping operator with the commands in RVEST like you would with those, which can help to improve just the readability of your code. And this one's also authored by Hadley Wickham, so it kind of follows a similar type of style. So here's an example of how we could use the RVEST package to scrape some data. So in this example, I've taken, let's have a look at this site. It's a basketball reference site that has some box scores. And I'm just going to close out the inspector for the moment. Okay, so I'm interested in some of these divisions, this division standing information. So like always, we go to the view source, and let's try to, now I'm going to look up some division to help to try to isolate. So I see this looks to be the area that has a day of interest. I can see the actual stat values here, so I know this is static data. So I can use, RVEST would only be something we would use if there was static data. Okay, so let's say that I'm interested in getting some of this information. So we're going to try to look at the Eastern Division standings. So the first thing I need is I'm going to load the package, and then I put in the URL for the page that we were just looking at. So let me go ahead and see if I can do that here. Erase what we had before. Okay. So the first thing in RVEST that we're using here is this read_HTML. So that's just going to bring in the contents from that HTML page, and we're going to store that as this object called web page. You could name that whatever you like, but in this example, I'm just calling it web page. Okay, so that'll now have the contents of the whole thing, but we don't want, you know, all of the information from the page. We just want some of the data from the particular table. So here's an example of how I would isolate the tables in that web page. So what I would do is I could use the piping command on the web page to say, okay, that's the object I'm looking at. Now there's this command called HTML_nodes. And what that does is allows you to give particular elements, either based on a CSS tag or an XPath selector. In this example, we're using the CSS command, and we're going to give it a table. So we're asking for all of the elements of the page that are within a table. We're going to collect those up, and I asked specifically for sort of a tabular content from those by then adding in the HTML table command. Okay, so let's have a look at exactly what that returns. So you'll see it's, we can use a class to see what kind of object this is. It's a list, and I've looked at the length, and we see that there are 7 elements in it. So let's have a look at the first few rows. Okay, so this seems to be some kind of score lines. And then by the fourth element, I see that I've gotten into the division standing information. And in each case, they're already in a data frame type of structure. Okay, but you could see that it's a little bit awkward because I just really wanted one particular division standings, and I didn't know because I just collected all of the tables. Now I've got to search manually to try to find the date of interest. So we'd like to make this set of commands more specific to that kind of data. So a table was a bit too general because the web page had multiple tables. So here's where the XPath command can be particularly useful because it generally allows more flexibility. Now, this XPath, it's an XML path language. So this is something that exists outside of R. It's a web language. And it's a bit more complicated to read. So this is one of the drawbacks. But it does allow you to get more specific. And a little bit of Googling will usually help you to identify. So if you know that, let's look back at our page here. And we're interested in the Eastern Division. Here we go. So if we look at, if we look more closely at the different contents, we can see that there's some ID information, and then we have this div standings. And that seems like if we're interested in the Eastern standings, that's going to be a more unique identifier than just a table. So I can use this through the XPath argument of that HTML nodes function. And this would be the XPath command to search for any IDs matching this div stands. And now we'll see in doing that, jumped ahead there, that the first object returned into our data will now be those Eastern Division standings. So this helps to just get more direct kind of scraping in place. So it's a combination of, you know, being able to inspect the elements of the site and identifying sort of unique identifiers for the elements that contain the data of interest. But essentially, you know, for things that are in a tabular structure, or even if it's maybe contained, let's say, in a paragraph element, you would be able to, you know, give that here and through the nodes command, and this will help to, you know, help clean up the data a bit. Now you can see that even though we have a nice data frame, there's still some issues here. Like the first row is really more of like header content. And then even within, you know, there may be things like these special characters that we'll need to clean up. So we'll see, that'll be part of sort of the wrangling activities. But already getting to this point is much more straightforward than if we had to, you know, look line by line in that web page. So those are all the basic elements that you'll need to know for using the RVEST. And then it's just a matter of, can you get to your data easily through a CSS? That's generally easier to find how you need to specify. Or an XPath, if that seems to be the only way to easily navigate to those contents, and then and just, you know, if you need to do that, just doing a little reading up on the XPath commands. Generally, the ID and the CSS class, those two are going to be the primary areas where you'll focus on and are generally going to be things that will identify those elements. So that should be enough to deal with most things that you'll come across. So let's do a little practice. You remember we've been looking at those ELO ratings. Try to take what we've discussed with this RVEST package to see how you would scrape the ELO ratings, the contents in those tables. One thing that I'll give you is a little shortcut. So if you have a table type of object and it has a class name, there's actually a shorthand that you And And the RVEST will interpret that as, oh, it's a table with this class, and that will help to localize that particular table. So with, that should be all the information you need to extract these data. So how would you get started? Does anyone have an idea what steps they would use for this one? So first thing we need to do is to read in the page. So we've got to get our URL in place and give that to the read underscore HTML function like we saw here. Okay, but now we've got a different URL because we're using this ELO site. But we should be able to go back to that. So this one's the ladies. You could do the WTA or the ATP. They both have the same structure. Okay, so this is a site. So this is where I could get the URL. And then I need that information about the elements of interest. So we've seen previously that it was a table. These data are contained in a table element. And we looked at this CSS class and ID. So given that shortcut I gave with the class, we'll probably want to use that version. Okay, so this is the key piece that we need. And then what we'll need is to apply the HTML nodes and HTML table to the web page content that we've read in. Okay. So putting all of that together, here are the steps you could use. So we saw that the class was table sorter, so I would use the table.table sorter to localize that particular table. And by default, it's going to correspond to the CSS argument for the HTML nodes function. Then I apply the HTML tables to extract the content just from that table. And we'll see, it always returns a list element. In this case, it's, I think, just be one element, and the first will be the actual data contents like we see them on the site. So really, the set of steps is very similar. The things that change are the URL and exactly the identifying material for the elements of interest, okay? And then from that point on, there might be some additional parsing and things we would do to clean up those data, but that would be essentially all the building blocks you would need for automating this process. Let's say these, for example, this site, it updates every week. So if I want to have a program in place that's going to scrape weekly as it updates, I could turn this into a function that would be able to do that over time, and I don't have to, you know, keep doing those steps myself. So that covers really the basics of static data, but a bit more complex one is dealing with the dynamic data. So when you're dealing with data that's sort of generated on the fly, what we need to do is, it is possible to scrape those data, but what we have to do is automate the browsing process itself. So just like we would interact with the site to be able to see those data, we have to do the same thing through our program script to be able to get access to them. In R, the package I think that best helps us to do this is R Selenium, and it's built off of a set of software called Selenium, which is all about automating browsing. So this is something that exists already out of R, and what R Selenium does is just brings those tools to us so that we can use it within the R console, and that's convenient for us because we can then apply analysis, put those into data frames, and then use the analysis tools that we're used to in R on those data. Okay, so the basic steps in using the R Selenium package is setting up the web driver, which is really just about establishing a browser that you're gonna be navigating with, finding the elements and the data, which is really just like what we've already seen with the static data example. So we'll have to be familiar with similar things like CSS identifiers, And the way in which we'll specify looking for those elements will be slightly different because it'll be using the functions of R Selenium. But conceptually, it's quite similar. We'll then have some tools in R Selenium for extracting those data. One thing, unfortunately, with these data, because R Selenium makes fewer assumptions about what it expects to see, so you will find that the data will be sort of less tidy when we have to scrape it in this way. But it's still much easier than doing any kind of like manual data collection. Okay. So with R Selenium, unfortunately, it's not enough just to be able to install the package. You also do have to set up this Selenium server, and exactly how to do that will depend on your system. But the basics would be to, if you follow this link or look for, you know, Selenium standalone Java program in Google, what you're going to look for is something like this package, Selenium server standalone. You'll want to download that, and you need that Selenium server running when we're using R Selenium in order to actually have the automated packages. So, for example, on the Mac OS, what I do whenever I know that I'm going to be doing dynamic scraping is I run this Java command in the terminal, and then the actual, these XX values will just correspond to what particular version of the Selenium server you're using. And in doing this command, you can also create a particular port. So let's say you have multiple browsers going on. You might want to have a dedicated port just for the scraping so that there's, you know, nothing about your other browsing activities that influences that collection process. So in that command, you could also specify a port. By default, it always goes to 4444, but you can control that. Once that is all set up, then it's just a matter of loading R Selenium, which you can download and install as normal from CRAN. Okay, so let's see some actual examples of this stuff in work. So let me open up an actual real example of some dynamic data. Okay. So I am going to go to this match statistics report. This is something from the Flash score site that I mentioned before. And what this is a set of match stats from the 2017 Australian Open men's final. So there's a whole set of data here about serve return stats. And let's suppose that I'm interested in scraping those data and creating a function that will maybe allow me to do this over time. So if I scan down, I see this section here about like the detail body, table detail. But if I look, you know, the table starts, the table ends here, there's actually no data. So this is a real example of dynamically generated data. So I see it here, but I cannot see it in the source. So I'm going to have to use R Selenium to get at some of these values here. Okay, but in that instruction, it is key to look at these ID, the class, because just as we saw with the static data examples, I'm going to need to use that in R Selenium to isolate those particular contents. Okay, so here's the basic steps. As I mentioned before, first, after loading our package, make sure the Selenium server's running in the background. That's something you'll have to do outside of R, as I showed with that Java command. Then we'll load R Selenium, and then, just as usual, I need the address. So this is that address for the match report that we were looking at. And next, what we do is to set up the driver. So the driver in R Selenium, server as well for that browser if it's not the default version. So in this example, I'm using prone on port 556. So that just establishes which browser settings I would be using. Next, I open the driver, and then I navigate to that particular page. So it's only at this point when I'm actually going to that site using the particular browser and settings that I've already established with that remote driver. When you do this, you'll actually see a website open up and go exactly to that page, and that's another check that, you know, it's working as expected. Once that driver is established and you've navigated to the page of interest, this is now the part where we're just finding those elements. So at that point, everything is set up to extract the data as you would see it on the site itself. Oh, sure, sure. So it's really just a series of, you know, remote driver, open navigate with the URL of interest. So this section here, this would all, you would just repeat that whenever you were going to a new site. So actually, once you've established a driver, you can then always, you know, navigate to a new URL from that same driver. And then, you know, when you ran a new session, you would just repeat those steps whenever you have a new R session. But once you've begun, it would just be a matter of changing the navigation if you wanted to use that to go to other sites as well. The Selenium server does not. You just have to make sure that it's running and is on the same port and using the same browser as what you specify in the remote driver. So I'll show the example for the Mac, but as I said, it may be slightly different depending on the server or your operating system. But here's the example. So I have, if I look in this, let me try to expand this here so you guys can see. Okay. So if I look in this directory,
I have the JavaScript function right here, Selenium server standalone. Sometimes it may also have some version content, but essentially it needs to be this jar file on the OS.
Now, the command that I would use to actually establish the server
is Java, and then there's this option here where I need to specify, because I like using Chrome, so I have to specify that driver here because it's not the default. And then I have option jar, and then it's the Selenium server. I'm just actually calling the actual executable. And here's an option I would get if I wanted to specify exactly which port. So in this case, it would be 5557. In the actual example we had, it was 5556. So if this is the server I would establish for that, then I would want to make sure that it was on the same port. So I could do that. And then as long as I have an internet connection, I will now see, if everything's gone successfully, I should see Selenium server is now running.
And that would be enough then to now be able to run this. So we see it's on the same port. And now you'll notice in the background that page is opened up, and this is now, you know, what we're interacting with within the R console. So I could actually, you know, navigate on it through the R Selenium commands, but the main thing we're interested in is just actually extracting the data contents. Okay, so yeah, as the resources I gave you on the installation will, you know, be the best way, because I'm most familiar with the Mac. I'm not exactly sure how things would work on Windows. I think it should be essentially the same. It's just a matter of how in Windows do you execute that JavaScript program. But the essential key is that you just need it running in the background. It doesn't have to be in the same directory or anything like that. I think the key is just making sure that the port and the browser match in both places. Okay, so once we have our once we've navigated to the site of interest, and we have the information about the elements that we want to use to actually get a hold of the data, we would use this find elements command. We would apply that then to our remote driver. And in this case, I'm going to use ID. So with this, we give the CSS tag of interest. So this could be a class. It could be a table that we supply to using. So I say I'm using the CSS ID, and then I give the actual value that that takes for the element of interest. So like we saw previously when we were looking at the contents of the site here, we have, so this is where I'm looking within the R Selenium. Okay, I'm going to store that as web element, and let me just go ahead and do that within the console here. And then I'm going to use the method getElementText, and it actually will, in the event that there's maybe, you know, multiple text elements, you could put this within like an lapply to just apply that across everything. And in this case, I've just run through everything in case there are multiple elements and then just taken the first. And that actually has all of the data of interest from the table. So I can refer back to the actual page, you know, just to understand how the contents from the page have been rendered in this string. So you'll see that this is really just a one-element string that it's returned when requesting the get element text, but it has all of the information that I was after. And then if I'm done with everything, let's see if I can go back to, then I would close out the driver once I'm finished using it. And in doing that, we'll see, let's see if we bring up, this is it, we should see our page close out then, so that's all it's doing. So you can see that a lot of these commands are really just, you know, doing the standard operations in when we're browsing, but it's just going through these R Selenium commands in R. Okay, so those are the basic steps. Let's just look at another example to see how this works. So here's another match report. This one's from the ATP site itself. And so let's have a look at this one. Okay, so this URL leads me to this another kind of match stat report. Again, a lot of like serve return stats. This was from one of the clay court matches this year. Again, if we go to our source and we can scroll down and we see like we're not really seeing the contents, so we can use our remote driver type of setup to try to get at these data. Okay, so if I look at the site, I find that there's one section that has this this ID about the match stats table. So fortunately, with the naming of that the designers of the site have used, it's pretty clear that that's probably the content I'm interested in. So I can use that in a similar way as we saw before. So you'll notice everything here is changing those first steps of establishing the site or just the URL. And then again, I'm doing find elements, and I just, the only thing that I'm changing is exactly the values for the CSS elements that I'm going to use. But once I do that, and then I do the get element text as before, and let's see if I actually go through this example. Do I have everything there? Yes. Okay, so it will open up the site. We'll see the page come up. Okay, there are the contents. So now I'm ready then to extract. So I'm going to be using the modal scores match stats table ID value to get at those data. And then again, this would be. So because we've been very specific in the ID we specify, generally you'll find that the first element should contain the content of interest. So very, very similar set of steps. So there is some trial and error. So with some of these sites, it might not be as obvious that, you know, you're using the right ID. So you might have to do a little bit of practicing or testing out different types of ID elements, because since the data isn't seen, you don't really know until you've actually run the commands whether or not you're getting at the right contents. But hopefully the few examples you've seen should sort of get you, you know, into identifying those classes, those IDs, focusing on those sections will generally get you in the right direction, so there shouldn't have to be too much of that. The nice thing is that once you've done that, in general, if you're working within the same site, like every match stats that I'm interested in from the ATP site, they're going to use that same element ID because, you know, there's no reason for them to create a new data structure unless they've done some kind of site overhaul. But as long as that site's fairly stable, you can expect that, you know, it's going to use the same CSS style, because it's all just defining kind of how that's presented. So as long as it's looking the same whenever you see it, it means, oh yeah, they're probably using the same ID, the same class style. So you should really only have to do that once, and then as much as you're going back to that site, it's really just a matter of, you know, it's a new match. So it's really the URL would be the only thing that would change. Okay, but you can see that this data is a bit messy, so we'll have to go on to our wrangling section to figure out how to clean that up. But just to summarize on this section, so we now know how to identify static dynamic data on the web, the elements around it to help us to uniquely identify them. If it's static data, we can use the rvest package tools to extract that and put it into a nice sort of data frame structure. And then if it's dynamic data, we can use R Selenium with the Selenium server to automate the process of extracting similar content. So now on to actually cleaning up that data once you've got it in place. So we'll do this. I'll try to get through. We'll see how much of this section we can get through, and then we'll take a brief break. Okay, so wrangling, another thing that can kind of give us headaches in R, but thankfully there's a lot of, most functions actually that we use in R are usually kind of cleaning up data, being able to manipulate the data. So this section of the talk is all about those common steps that we have to do, and it's really all about kind of tidying up messy data from the web. And normally when we're thinking about tidying, it's like we have something like this, it's kind of all over the place, and eventually we want to put things in a nice row by column structure and make sure that the values are represented in the way that they should be for us to use for analysis. So because of the kinds of ways that we can get data, one of the key things that we'll have to be able to do is string manipulation, because often our data might actually just exist as a single string. So the Stringer package has a number of tools that kind of put a lot of the steps that we'll need for pattern matching, extracting elements from the string, that are going to be the common things when doing this sort of parsing. So the string manipulation is a big part. And then once we actually have data, maybe in some kind of structure, we need to be able to select, transform the data, and then maybe even reshape the data set itself, going in between wide and long formats. And often, you know, making sure that we do some check of the validity of the values that we're seeing, looking for missing values, or if the missing values aren't rendered in the appropriate way, making sure that we convert them if needed. So those are all really common steps in getting sports data into a shape that you can actually use. So from our previous example that where we collected those match stats, let's suppose that I stored that as this match stats variable. And what we ended up with was just a single string, and it's got a whole lot of content, including like the names of the stats of interest and their actual values, with a lot of extra kind of characters like percentages and parentheses that we're going to need to clean up. So just looking at that, we can already see a number of things we're going to have to do is, firstly, we need to know what kind of structure do we want to put these data in, because you don't want to just start aimlessly, you know, manipulating things until you know clearly, like, what is the end goal that I want when I'm going to be using these data. Once we do that, we can already see that there's going to be some string splitting that we'll need to use. We need to be able to extract values and separate them from the variable labels, and then put all of this into a data frame, and possibly do some variable conversion, because everything's going to be kind of, the underlying data is all a character, but we know some of those should really be numeric, and so on. Okay, so that first bit, with the target structure. In this case, looking at those data, I have a number of different types of statistics. I have two players, and then the values that those statistics would take. So one option would be a long format like this, where we would have a label that would essentially tell me which statistic I'm looking at for that particular row. And then I could have its value, and then I could have an indicator telling me, is it, you know, player one or player two? So it's not the only structure that you can consider, but let's suppose this is the one that I'm wanting to put the data into for this particular example. So this example, I've said, is an example of a long format. What would be the difference if I wanted to put into a wide format? How would that structure change? How might you describe that structure? Yeah, so I mean, the basic thing when going from long to wide, long is generally you have sort of all of the data just stacked on top of each other, and wide is generally you're going from few columns, generally you can think of it as like a key value kind of pairing structure, to multiple columns. So one way that could be represented is we might put the stats along the column, and that would probably be the widest structure you could imagine for these data. You could also do by player and still keep the stats sort of in a long format as well. But this would be one example of what that kind of choice might look like. Okay, but same within this long format target. The first thing we need to do is to kind of split up this string. So we can do that with the string split command. So once I've loaded this string or I would do the string underscore split, and I have to decide what value, what element I'm going to split on, because what will happen is every time that element occurs, what this function will do is to, you know, split at that point, and so you'll have all of the elements separated based on that character. So looking back at this object, we can see so I will use that in the splitting command, and the result will be a list. And the first element in this case, because I only had a single string, I'll just have a single element in that list. And it will be, all of the separated values between those return key characters. So I can see it's a mix of some labeling information and then actual values. More specifically, if I look closely, let's see if we may still have that page open. Okay. So let's look here at this first example. We see aces for Zverev 7, for Djokovic 1. And if I look back at these, at my match stats variable, okay, here we go. So if I look back here, I see it has one player, it has a label, and then it has the other player value. And if I look again at the other stats, I see it follows that same structure. So that's an important pattern to know when we're going to be organizing these data into the final data frame. So now that we have these, we need to separate out the statistics values from their labels. And again, we can use some functions in the stringer package for this. So there are a few type of pattern matching functions. We have the string detect, which is essentially a kind of conditional test. So I would give it a pattern here, and then that pattern would be applied to the object given under X, and then it would return trues and falses wherever that pattern was matched along the elements of the X object. And that same sort of input values, we would always give that same object pattern type of command. But with the subset and extract, we'll get slightly different results. So with the subset, then that would be in the case where we actually just wanted to go ahead and extract to the values that have a matching pattern. So rather than trues and falses, we'll actually just get the return values wherever the pattern was matched. And with the extract, it'll actually take out specific values from the string, the matching strings themselves, if we just wanted to isolate those portions. So maybe our pattern is a number, give me any numeric value. So it would return the first matching occurrence of the numeric pattern wherever it occurred along the element. So there's a variety of tools for pattern matching depending on what you need. With the pattern, in general, you're going to be using regular expressions. It is possible to do patterns with sort of fixed patterns where you want it to just match exactly as you've written it in the pattern. But more commonly, the more powerful way to do matching if you're doing a lot of string manipulation is with regular expressions. So this is a kind of pattern matching language that exists, in all parts of the kind of programming that's out there. You can do it on shell commands. So it's a good thing to know. It's fairly complex. I won't go too much into it. But here are some common examples. For example, if we wanted to match any capital letter in the alphabet, it would be this bracketed A hyphen Z. This is the lowercase equivalent. So I can match these together, the lowercase with the uppercase, and then that would just match any sort of letter. Similarly, if I wanted to get any numeric, it would be with the 0 hyphen 2n in brackets, or any vowel. This would match any vowel. So those are just some examples that kind of get you. And there's a link here that would be in the PDFs if regular expressions are new to you, where you can read up on some of the common patterns that you might be interested in. And we'll see some examples here for sorting this particular data example. So let's say that once I've done the split, I'm going to take that first element where all the contents were and store it as split. The pattern in this case that I'm interested in is I want to identify just the labeling, the elements that just give me the name of the statistics in this match report. I can do that with the regular expression of the lowercase letters. And next what I do is use that pattern with my data object, and I'm going to subset just to those labels that match. So in the end, what this will give me it's going to isolate
just these statistics. So aces, double faults, first service, and so on, because they'll all have a lowercase letter. So it's going to not pay attention to any of that header content at the top that has the player names and things, because they're actually not giving us any information about the statistics of interest. Okay, next, we now want to isolate the values that correspond with those stats. So here I'm using the detect to create a true and false condition. The first is going to give me trues and falses wherever a stat label was matched. And then the second here is giving me cases where any capital, so that would capture that stuff at the top, that header information, in addition. And now what I'm doing is I'm taking both of those conditions and I'm saying only return the things that do not match either of those patterns. So that's what the exclamation at the front is doing. It's turning all of those trues into falses. And in the end, what that should isolate would just be the values from our object here. So So one question, why didn't I just ask to subset on the numeric regular expression just like I did here? Why, this seems maybe overly complicated.
Because there is a first player on the screen, and the first one.
Exactly, yeah. So some of the labels have numeric values in it, so it wouldn't quite get us exactly the values of interest. But there are other alternatives to doing this. So I know the regular expressions might be new, so even if you don't maybe know exactly how you would write it, think about what might be another way that you could isolate the values. Does anyone have an idea? Maybe
what?
So maybe you could use the sort of pattern in terms of, you know, you know that there's like a value, a label, a value. So if that pattern held, we could potentially use that. But I'm thinking here of more of one of our string manipulation, if I could just use a single stringer command. So this was one example, but here's another one that you could potentially use. So we know that the numeric won't identify exactly, but if we look back, we see that the values generally always have either they end with a numeric value, or they may contain some kind of parentheses or percentage. So what I'm asking for here is, like, if any of those, either it ends in a parentheses, a number, or a percentage, that has to be a value. So this first bracketed element, it says either numeric, right-hand parentheses, or percentage. And those backslashes that you see, those are escape commands to say treat that like a fixed value. Don't treat it like a special regular expression character, because the parentheses, for example, will be used as a grouping operator in a regular expression. So we don't want to do that. We'll say make sure it does have any special meaning. Don't use that. That final dollar sign means it has to be the last character in the string. So this would be another way to get to the same result as this one. So a lot of it's just kind of what's more intuitive, like what pattern first occurs to you. There's not always just one thing. Okay, and we already looked at why we didn't use this version, because it would give us kind of a mixture of labels and numbers. All right, so now we've got our stat labels and our values separated, and we're ready to just start to put that into a data frame structure. One thing that makes these data a little bit tricky is that actually, for the first two values, it looked like we just had, you know, stat value, label, value. But actually, if we kept looking, once we get into these, like, percentages type of stats, so these are just counts, but these percentage ones, they actually return two different values, so they give the percentage and then they give the actual numerator. two values. So it's a little bit of a complication, but one way that we can deal with that is if I've looked over and I see, okay, aces, double faults, service games played, return games played, those are the only stats that are counts. So I'll just create a conditional object counts that will identify when those occur among our stats labels. So that's what I'm doing in that first step there. So it'll just be a true false vector that is of equal length to counts and indicates basically when I know that I need two places of values versus four. So then I use that information here, and it tells me how I need to appropriately expand the stat. So anytime it encounters one that's a count, it'll just do two repetitions, and then whenever it doesn't, when it's a false, it will do four. And that'll give me the appropriate length of these repetitions, because in our original extraction, right, we just had a double false, right? So now we've got to repeat because we have multiple values for each player. And then I just give a spot for the values because they're already in the appropriate order. And that gives me at least a starting structure for my data frame. So one of the things you notice in our values, right, they still have these percentages and other content. If we actually want to use those as numeric values, we need to get rid of that stuff so that we can appropriately convert those data. So the first step that you would consider there would be to do a replace or a substitution. With the stringer package, you can use the string replace all as a way to do any kind of substitution. In this case, we just want to remove those types of characters. So here, this command is saying, if you encounter any parentheses, so a left-handed parentheses, a percentage, or a right-handed parentheses, and again, we're using the escape characters on the parentheses. I've put those in brackets, so what it's saying is anytime you encounter any of those, I'm going to replace it with nothing. So it's just going to entirely remove it. If you sometimes want to actually replace with a different value, you would just alter that last part of the function to give it the replacement pattern or character of interest. So in the end, if I apply this to the values, you'll see that I'm now structure so that I can just do like an as numeric to convert those. So the next thing that we'll have to do is to take care of these backslashes as well. So combining the string replace that we already took and then the last thing that we have to do is then also handle these. Does anyone know if I were to do an as numeric with something like this, what would happen? Does anyone know? I hear murmurs, but.
Float numbers?
What will do?
Decimal numbers, float numbers?
Well, we'd like it to do that in this case, right? But essentially, we're almost asking it to divide to do a function. But if I just say as numeric, it doesn't know to do that. So in this case, you'll get NAs wherever you have something that has this kind of backslash in it. So we have to deal with that too. So here's how we can do it. It's a little bit more complicated, but we can combine some of the dplyr functions to do this. So I do the first step to clean out the percentages and the parentheses. Now I just need to handle these ratios. I want to actually convert them into a decimal point type of value. But to do that, I'll actually have to do it kind of like a division operation. So I'm using the mutate, we'll see that this is one of the key functions part of the dplyr package for sort of data manipulation. And what mutate does is just allow me to make changes to values that are in an existing data frame. So I store things in this match stats. And now what I do is I go along and I first use the string detect to say, okay, if there isn't any slash, then here, then I'm using the forward slash, which is a division operation in R. You can use it, you know, in your console. It's actually interesting that a lot of these, sometimes you don't see, like if I do this operation, it knows when I do it in the console that it's a division operation. And it's an example, actually, of a type of operator object, which is also a function, just like others. Normally, we're used to using functions where we give it, a name, and then we have parentheses, and then we give some values for arguments. Those operators actually can be used in the same way. We just normally don't, because they have this kind of nice shorthand that's more convenient. But in this case, it actually helps to know that we can use operators as functions like that, because now I can give the first value as the numerator, and then just use an extract all string command to match that first, and I take the first element that's a number, I know that's my numerator, and then I do the same, and this time I take the second element, which gives me my denominator, and so I'm giving my numerator first, have my comma, and so this would be the result here. So I'm just, I've just subset it to the first service points one, but now you'll see that you get the corresponding proportion for all of those percentages, and now I have a column of values that are actually all numeric. Okay, well, before we go into tidying, since it's about a quarter after, why don't we go ahead and take a break at this point, and we'll try to meet back here, let's say, in 15 minutes, so just around 11:30.